Seekers, welcome to the Malloy program. It's about 7 past the hour. We have a lot of ground to cover tonight, including reports from Occupy Oakland, Occupy what is becoming Occupy Berkeley, and any of the other correspondents who've been checking in with the program these past several weeks. Right now we are joined by Bill Dobbs, who's with Occupy Wall Street, a member of the Occupy press team. Hi, Bill.
Hi, Mike.
Like everybody else in the country, I'm fully aware of what happened early this morning and the court case that the Occupy movement sought, or the court order that the Occupy movement sought. What I understand is that the judge in that case issued an order saying that the park could be occupied, but only up until a certain time each day and without tents or sleeping bags. Is that correct?
I don't think the dust has settled on that decision yet, and what I'll say is that people have more rights than they might realize, and the way to hang on to those rights and to get even more rights is to use them. So we don't know how it's going to play out tonight, but Occupy Wall Street here in New York has been giving off a loud outcry for the last almost 2 months now, and people are starting to listen.
Yeah, that's very true. In the discussions that we've had on this program, the discussions at Occupy in D.C., and with the October 2011.org movement, we've come to the conclusion that the success of Occupy has already been firmly established, in that the consciousness of this country has been raised with these various occupations. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Putting the 99%, we are the 99%, into the stratosphere, public conversations, discussions,
right.
That's remarkable progress, because it's about who gets what, who has a safety net, whether that be Social Security or any health care at all, or reasonably priced health care, and also who gets thrown under the bus.
One of the issues that came up last night on the program was with a guy who called in from Raleigh, with the Occupy movement in Raleigh. And the suggestion or the discussion he wanted to have was about trying to focus or organize the possible political energy in the Occupy movement. And, of course, I and a couple of the other callers pointed out to him that that's not what Occupy is all about. How do you prevent this movement now from going the way of so many movements, where it begins to take the form of a political entity, or it begins to take the form of a leader or leaders emerging? How do you deal with that?
I think Occupy, it takes a little thinking to dig below the surface. I'm glad you're onto it, because many people, their entire political possibilities are either go to a voting booth or put your feet up. And a lot of people increasingly are putting their feet up because they're so cynical. What Occupy is laying out for people, and this is me talking, you know, I don't know that we have a official GA position on these sorts of things, is be the squeaky wheel.
Right.
That we're giving off an outcry, and others have to come along and take on pieces of that political work. And if you can figure out how to organize around issues rather than around candidates, parties, elections, we're going to get a lot further. That means not ignoring electoral politics or the people in power, but keep them jumping, stay at an arm's length, rather than discovering that if they've given you a kiss on the cheek, suddenly you're in a bear hug and can't breathe. The union leader put it this way: we can't be in the hall chatting up politicians. We got to be in the street. That's what Occupy Wall Street has given us. Now, that's both a high compliment, and it's a political lesson, which is you can easily get bogged down and diverted into thinking you've elected people who are friends to office. Now all we have to do is go talk and meet with them. But if you get out in the street, or you're the squeaky wheel, don't always have to be out in the street, but the real squeaky wheel stuff, that sends a jolt through them. And that's one of the lessons of Occupy. Send a jolt through the system.
Absolutely. And I spoke recently in Washington and subsequently got arrested along with a bunch of other people. But one of the people that I found advantageous to quote, of course, is Mario Savio, the free speech movement, the statement that we're all familiar with that he gave in October, October 1964 at Sproul Plaza. And that all that was necessary in his time anyway, he said, if 1,000 people will just sit down, if 1,000 people just refuse to move, it'll stop any kind of machine. This was after he said, of course, about there comes a time when you have to throw your body onto the gears. And I think of anything. Well, the only thing, the major thing, the absolute necessary thing that Occupy has done to this point has brought that finally into focus. We've talked about this many times in the program. Every single protest movement in this country has either had an objective or a leadership or a goal, and some of them were real honorable, the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement. But so many of them then degenerate into the kind of infighting or the kind of power plays, and eventually the machine, if you will, dissolves the movement. Now, some of the goodness of good actions of the movement become part of the law of the land, i.e. the civil rights movement, but the machine eventually devours it. It just absorbs it, takes it in, and eventually it passes out the other end. And what's left is a memory, an echo. Gee, I remember the anti-nuke movement. Gee, I remember the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Gee, I remember this and that. I watched ABC News tonight. Diane Sawyer could not control. She couldn't contain herself when she had to let her audience know that the police had moved in and cleared out those nasty, dirty people in the park. And she asked the question in her tease to the story, who should pay the cost of cleaning up? Jesus Christ, you know, did she ask that of the bankers who destroyed the hopes of millions of people? Of course not. But I think, and I hope I'm on the right page here, that what Occupy has accomplished to this point is this consciousness raising without making any effort, just by declaring what they're about and letting people try to figure it out.
Yes, it's a two-step. We're gonna give an off the outcry, and we've been totally focused on that. The second step of it, though, people gotta relearn how to organize and claim the right to protest, pick an issue, and chew ferociously on that issue until something budges. Don't get seduced into being too friendly with politicians. You keep your thing firmly planted outside, and you're that squeaky wheel. You're gonna get it.
Yeah, and it goes back. You know, it's a shame that we have to relearn this, it seems, although I think this time, this generation is learning it for the first and perhaps the last time. But what Saul Alinsky said about organize, and this, I hope, will be, and I'm sure it will, be the outcome of the Occupy movement. It's not to form a political party. It's not to put candidates forward. It is to organize. And that's the one thing that the 1% is terrified of, is organization. That's the reason they look for leaders. That's the reason they look for identifiers. Who are you? What do you want? Who's your leadership? So we can kill them, in a manner of speaking. So, the Alinsky idea, Saul Alinsky's idea from all those years ago, whether it's a rent strike or labor issues or whatever it is, organize. And I hope people will, as they say, I hope that's a takeaway from the Occupy movement.
Well, you said something I think very important about, tactics and what can shake up people in power. The park, the plaza, Liberty Square as we call it in New York, is not even as big as many suburban backyards.
Right.
It's a tiny thing, but it has radiated out to the world, and really by doing two things. One, having people camped out there, and second, by going out marching with signs and chants in groups on the sidewalk. this simple act, hoping that people will look at those signs and listen to the chant, is such a potent thing.
It is.
That it sends tremors through these high rises with very powerful people in them, and it's caused well over 1,000 arrests. Nobody's going out wanting to pick a confrontation with the cops,
right?
Because we're really interested in talking about economic conditions in the country. But that very powerful tactic is something that's very easy.
Bill, I've got to take a quick break here. If you'll hold on, because I want to chat with you just another couple of minutes. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Don't go to bed angry. Let Mike do it for you. It's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. By the way, this hour is sponsored by Allison, Arkansas, who thanks the suffragettes who sacrificed so much so women could vote. A little bit more on that in a moment. Bill Dobbs is a member of the Occupy press team at Occupy Wall Street. Just a slight peek into future activity at Zuccotti Park. Not that it's all that significant, but that's where the focus is. What do you think is going to happen next, Bill?
Nobody can see into the future, but one thing is on the two-month anniversary, which is Thursday, November 17th, we've got a whole bunch of actions planned all day long. And for people who are in the New York area, or even if they're not, nycga.net will give you details, and so will OccupyWallST.org.
All right. I'm sure everybody will check out those sites. Bill, thanks a lot for taking time to check in with us tonight. Take care, okay?
Thank you.
All right, we'll talk again. Bill Dobbs with the Occupy Wall Street Press. Press what? What do you call it, Kathy? Press office? In 1917, here's an example how it never stops. In 1917, the National Women's Party, yeah, there was such a thing, began picketing the White House for the right to vote. The government decided that the National Women's Party's militant tactics were misguided at a time when the country was entering a world war. Members of the National Women's Party, on the other hand, believed it was as important to extend democracy at home as it was to defend it in war abroad. The federal government took action against the National Women's Party after protesters picketed outside the White House for several months. Beginning in June 1917, our government, arrested and imprisoned suffragists, most of whom were incarcerated at the Occoquan Workhouse in Fairfax County, Virginia. Months of unhygienic conditions, forced labor, meager and unsanitary food, hunger strikes, and forced feedings of strikers culminated in what has been called the Night of Terror. On November 15th, 1917, while American troops were fighting in Europe, making the world safe for democracy, it was put then, 33 women who had been arrested for peacefully picketing the White House for the right to vote were brutally attacked by as many as 40 club-wielding guards. They beat Lucy Burns, chained her hands to the cell bars above her head, and left her there for the night. They hurled Dora Lewis into a dark cell, smashed her head against an iron bed, and knocked her out cold. Her cellmate, Alice Kosu, who believed Mrs. Lewis to be dead, suffered a heart attack. According to affidavits, other women were grabbed, dragged, beaten, choked, slammed, pinched, twisted, and kicked. Word spread of the brutal treatment of the suffragists, and they were all released at the end of November 1917. It took three more years of struggle before women were granted the right to vote. So thank you, Lucy Burns, Alice Paul, Dora Lewis, Alice Kossu, and all the other women who put their lives on the line so women could vote. Signed, Alice in Arkansas, who is our sponsor for all 3 hours tonight. You didn't know that, did you, Truth Seeker? You didn't know about the National Women's Party. Most of what we're told in our history books about the suffragette movement is about the parades and the women in the turn-of-the-century skirts down to their ankles and the bonnets marching with their signs down Pennsylvania Avenue or Fifth Avenue or wherever they marched. That's what we're told about, right? Until finally in 1920, Congress passed the amendment that gave women the right to vote. But how many of us know about the Night of Terror? How many of us know about the women who had been arrested for peacefully picketing the White House for the right to vote, who were brutally attacked by club-wielding guards? That was 1917. This is 2011. Thanks to Alice in Arkansas for the history lesson. It is something that pretty much is left out of whatever. And, you know, once you get to university, if you want to take a course in how the Constitution was amended, in various amendments, you might come across this, but where it really counts, down on the middle school or a high school level, where young girls have the opportunity to learn about this stuff. Is it still being taught? Has this part of it, the Night of Terror, ever been taught? We'll be right back.
Down to the very last breath.
Against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored tonight by Alice in Arkansas. You know who she is. You know who she is. And just one last thing I want to mention. This has nothing to do with her sponsorship, but she sent me something. Whipped Shea Mint Cream for your elbows and your knees this winter. Oh, my God.
I might have to eat.
I know. You can spoon this onto a piece of cornbread. And
I have to say something, Alice. All your products are wonderful, but I'll tell you what. The strange, sad truth is my dog licks me everywhere after I use it. It's hilarious. He knows whatever room I'm in the house where I put lemon hemp cream on my hands, and he comes scampering no matter where I am and licks it off. So it's that good.
It is good. The dog's probably going to have
a
heart
attack.
Even
your dog will love it.
It's our sponsor by Alice in Arkansas, who says thanks to the suffragettes who sacrificed so much so women could vote. Phew. from Juan. Mike, I've written you a few times about my son Christopher and his role in the Occupy Wall Street battleground. He is my hero. This morning he called me at 12:30 a.m. our time. He yelled, "Dad, I'm heading there. The police are herding my friends and breaking our things down." I replied, "Chris, be careful. They will mace and beat you with their clubs." He replied, "Dad, we're going to take our country back." All day he kept me informed, and when I didn't hear from him, I feared the worst. He says every day that he'll be there till they win. Juan. In Hawaii, at the APEC dinner, there's an Asia-Pacific Economic Conference or whatever, economic cooperation. There was a dinner last night, a gala, and the world leaders who were sitting there about to chow down on, 8 trillion calories per plate got a surprise. During the dinner, the renowned Hawaiian guitarist Makana, who performed at the White House in 2009, opened his suit jacket to reveal a homemade Occupy with Aloha t-shirt. And then instead of playing the expected instrumental background music, he spent almost 45 minutes repeatedly singing his protest ballad released earlier that day. The ballad is called "We Are the Many" and includes lines such as, "The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw, and until they are purged, we won't withdraw." The song ends with the refrain, "We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you, till you do the bidding of the many, not the few." You gotta love this guy. He said, "At first I was worried about playing We Are the Many, but I found it odd that I was afraid to sing a song I'd written, especially since I'd written it with these people in mind." The gala was the most secure event of the summit. It was held inside the Halikoa Hotel. Is that right? I hope so. A 72-acre facility owned and controlled by the U.S. Defense Department. The site was fortified with an additional 3 miles of fencing, constructed solely for the APEC summit. Makana was surprised that no one objected to him playing the overtly critical song. He said, "I just kept doing different versions. I must have repeated the bidding of the many, not the few line at least 50 times like a mantra. It was surreal and sobering." Oh, God. And apparently when the gig was over, he left. This was posted at yeslab.org, if you want to check it out yourself, yeslab.org. In Berkeley, although I don't have an update, this next hour, hopefully we might get an update. This has nothing to do with Occupy. A man was shot by University of California police officers inside the Haas School of Business on the UC Berkeley campus this afternoon. It was around 2:15 California time. A man with a gun inside the Haas School of Business. Police shot and wounded one suspect who's now in custody. Students and faculty were evacuated. The suspect is a 33-year-old man who had not been identified by police when I got this. He was transported to hospital, but his condition is unknown. On the other side of the campus, students and Occupy protesters are holding a huge protest. Police say it doesn't appear the shooting was related to the protest. From Steve, in the subject line, Steve writes, "Is there any effing doubt now?" He writes, "Fascism is no longer coming. It is here. I was at Occupy Wall Street tonight, Mike, as someone who stood on the sidelines too long. I'm now in this game. The cops have drawn a line in the sand. It's time for each person to take a side." And this was sent to me about an hour ago. And this appeared first at The Guardian, the UK's website, as part of their Occupy Comment is Free series. At 4 in the morning in Lower Manhattan, at what remains of the Occupy Wall Street encampment. As it is loaded into trash compactors, some protesters have still not given up on the police. Kevin Schenneberger tries to engage one NYPD officer in a serious debate about the role of law enforcement in public protest. Then he sees them loading his friend's tent into the back of a rubbish truck. Behind him, a teenage girl holds a hastily written sign that says, NYPD, we trusted you. You were supposed to protect us. That sentiment is a familiar one. Across Europe, only a year of over a year of demonstrations, occupations, and civil disobedience, anti-austerity protesters have largely shifted from declaring solidarity with the police, as fellow workers whose jobs and pensions are also under threat, to outrage and anger at state violence against unarmed protesters. Following last month's police brutality in Oakland, and today's summary eviction of the Occupy Wall Street camp, American activists, too, are reaching the conclusion that, quote, police protect the 1%, end quote. The notion that law enforcement is there to protect a wealthy elite from the rest of the population is not news to those protesters from deprived and ethnic minority backgrounds, many of whom have been subjected to intimidation in their communities for years. But for those from more privileged backgrounds, the first spurt of pepper spray to the face is an important education in the nature of the relationship between state and citizen in the United States, in the West, generally. Who do you guys work for? Shouts one Manhattan protester as police load arrestees into a van. You work for J.P. Morgan Bank. In times of economic and democratic crisis, it makes sense for faltering governments to use police violence and the threat of arrest to bully citizens into compliance. In the context of protest, however, police harassment has three other important effects. The first and most important of these is consciousness raising. The spectacle of police beating and brutalizing unarmed civilians for the crime of sitting on the pavement and demanding a fair world brings home the point of the struggle to public and protesters alike. The second is galvanizing. That is, attacks on peaceful protesters rarely make the police or government look anything but weak and cowardly, and have tended only to increase public support for civil disobedience. 26-year-old Katie says, this is going to explode now as we watch demonstrators marched out of Zuccotti Park one by one. She says they don't realize what they've done. Fighting the police can focus the energy of a movement, but it can also drain that energy. In Britain, a year of arrests and vicious crackdowns have left anti-cuts protesters debilitated and depleted. And the challenge for the American movement will be to remember its purpose in the face of police brutality. As one protester said, quote, that's the whole point of nonviolent resistance. It exposes the corruption of the power that's resisting you, end quote. What is really kind of comical to me in the darkest sense of that word is the idea that must be in the heads of the mayors and the police chiefs and the administrators who believe that clearing the parks and throwing away people's belongings and ripping down their tents and putting them in garbage barrels, that somehow that's going to stop the Occupy movement. For you people who believe that, you have to be effing kidding yourselves. You really do.
Someday, I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss?
Someday it's going to come. Tear it down. Oh, promised land. What a wicked...
Raptor Seekers, Uncle Mikey has another bedtime story. Back to Mike Malone.
10 before the hour. Regarding the unreported violence that occurred at Occupy Wall Street last night or early this morning when the police moved in, there's a place where you can get some pretty good information about this. Go to Brad Friedman's website, bradblog.com. He has some a couple of pieces there, along with some a video about other stories, but he also has video from the police riot last night at Zuccotti Park. It was pretty bad, and it's not being reported. So go to bradblog.com, bradblog.com, and check out what Brad Friedman has up. And again, this hour, well, the entire program tonight is sponsored by Allison, Arkansas. She's the woman who has Helen Hollers, one of our sponsors that have been with us forever. You can go to our website, MikeMalloy.com, click on Helen Hollers, Allison, Arkansas, banner ad, and start buying some products for winter, especially you people who listen in the north. Come on. All right. Thanks, Alice. And her message, Alice in Arkansas, thanks the suffragettes who sacrificed so much so women could vote. That's her message for this hour. We have quite a bit more of the Occupy movement to cover tonight. I realize that so much of the program is focused down on this or up on this, but I think it's absolutely necessary. And after the break at the top of the hour, we are going to open the phones in case any of the people who have been checking in from the various Occupy movements want to call in tonight. There is other stuff. I just couldn't get over Diane Sawyer tonight. You know, when the program first started, ABC News program first started, and she's teasing the stories that are coming up during the 22 minutes that she's on the air. That's how she justifies her $8 million a year contract. You know, 22 minutes a night, five nights a week, and occasional other jobs, of course. But she wanted to know, she said, the question tonight after Zuccotti Park, or whatever it's, she referred to it as, cleared of the Occupy Wall Street protesters, who is going to pay for the cleanup? Who's going to pay for the extra, you know, it's like, oh my God, who's going to pay for the extra police? Well, in the first place, what the hell are the police doing there to begin with? You know, you have a bunch of cops who are drawing overtime. That's Mayor Bloomberg's paranoia. I don't know what the hell that is. But, you know, don't send the cops down and have to pay all that money and then say, well, who's going to pay for it? Jesus Christ, Diane, you're going to pay for it. Who do you think is going to pay for it? But it's your world that Bloomberg is trying to protect, Ms. Sawyer. It's your world. Hey. Oh, and by the way, Rastaman wants me to know, just a little FYI for you and the Occupy Wall Street folks, the atrium of Trump Tower is legally designated public space. Rastaman says, just thought you'd like to know that. Really? The atrium of Trump Tower is legally designated public space. wouldn't Donald Trump just, you know, that thing he wears on his head would just flop and try to fly away, wouldn't it? If a bunch of folks showed up and said, hi, Donald, we're here to burn your ass at the stake. Just kidding. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah, and there's this. I've just got to get this in. The Catholic Church's pedophilia investigator in charge of child protection and interviewing adults who as children had been victims of pedophile priests was jailed today on pedophile charges in England. The 49-year-old Christopher Jarvis, a married man with four children of his own, began serving his 12-month sentence after serving the Catholic Church for 9 years in a diocese that included 120 Catholic churches. Mr. Jarvis admitted to the charges, which included possession of 4,000 images of prepubescent boys, including several depicting sadism, child rape, and torture. At the time of his arrest last March, Jarvis was leading an investigation into an historic sex abuse allegation at Buckfast Abbey, a Benedictine monastery in Devon. He was arrested after uploading images of prepubescent boys on the Ning social networking website. Police officers who traced him to his home in Plymouth, Devon, found more than 4,000 child porn images, mainly of boys aged 10 to 12, on his church-supplied computer and a memory stick when they raided the house. The court heard that 4,389 images were found on the laptop and memory stick. The majority were at level 1, the lowest level for abusive images, but there were 120 at level 4, which includes scenes of child rape, and 12 at level 5, which includes scenes of torture and sadism. The Catholic Church's pedophilia investigator began serving his 12-month sentence today. Hi, Truth Seekers. This hour is sponsored by Alice in Arkansas. Coming up next hour, I might as well tell you now, I'm going to be talking a little bit about this decision that the Supreme Court has made to hear the legal challenges by, 23 or 26 states regarding the 2010 health care overhaul. The Obama administration put together. So stick around for that. Anyway, this hour, Alice in Arkansas sponsors it. She had the message this hour is a quote from Abigail Adams. Yeah, that Adams. The quote, "If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." Yow. And by way of explanation, uh, this date in history. I'm just going to do it again. I did it last hour, but I think it bears repeating because so many of us are unaware of this. In 1917, the National Women's Party, NWP, began picketing at the White House for the right to vote. The U.S. government decided that their so-called militant tactics were misguided at a time when the country was entering a world war. Members of the NWP, on the other hand, believed it was as important to extend democracy at home as it was to defend it in war abroad. The federal government, our federal government, took action against the NWP, and after protesters picketed outside the White House for several months. Beginning in June 1917, the government arrested and imprisoned suffragettes, most of whom were incarcerated at the Occoquan Workhouse in Fairfax County, Virginia. Months of unhygienic conditions, forced labor, meager and unsanitary food, hunger strikes, and forced feedings of strikers culminated in what has been called the Night of Terror. On November 15th, this date in 1917, while American troops were fighting in Europe, allegedly making the world safe for democracy, 33 women who had been arrested for peacefully picketing the White House for the right to vote were brutally attacked by club-wielding guards, as many as 40 of them. They beat Lucy Burns, chained her hands to the cell bars above her head, and left her there for the night. They hurled Dora Lewis into a dark cell, smashed her head against an iron bed, and knocked her out cold. Her cellmate, Alice Kosu, who believed Miss Lewis to be dead, suffered a heart attack. According to affidavits, other women were grabbed, dragged, beaten, choked, slammed, pinched, twisted, and kicked. Word spread of the brutal treatment that the suffragettes were getting, and they were all released at the end of November 1917. It took three more years of struggle before women were granted the right to vote. So thank you, Lucy Burns, Alice Paul, Dora Lewis, Alice Kosu, and all the other women who put their lives on the line so that women could vote. Signed, Allison Arkansas. She's the woman who has Helen Hollers, one of our advertisers. So if you want to thank Alice for that bit of research, go to her website, send her an email. Okay. Before we take your, by the way, the phones are open, 877-996-2556, but I want to get Prairie 2's missive in for tonight. Subject line says, Congress shall make no law, or abridge, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That's just the subject line. He writes, Euro-denominated bonds sold off big today, and this drove the price down and interest rates up, even in the northern European countries where the right-wing wisdom holds that the people are hardworking, tax-paying, frugal, and, white. The only exception was Germany, which is considered the last safe haven for the euro, and their interest rates fell on high demand for bonds. U.S. stocks were up in late trading despite the gloom and doom in Europe and the potential risk to U.S. banks. As the basic economic news in the U.S. remains positive, consumer sales were up in October and manufacturing surveys suggest significant growth, which was the opposite of the conventional wisdom of surveyed economists. It wasn't all good news. Hourly wages adjusted for inflation have fallen nearly 2% in the last 12 months. Declining wages are indicated by the continuing high weekly jobless claims as better paid workers are fired in favor of minimum wage workers. In Texas, many of the almost forgotten Rick Perry's jobs are less than minimum wage. Speaking of the forgotten governor of Texas, Iowa's Republican primary is only 49 days away. It has become a four clowns in a pie fight circus. Herman Cain leads at 20%, having locked up the misogynist vote. He's followed by Ron Paul with the libertarian fantasy vote at 19%. Then you have Mitt Romney with the "we're okay with Mormons if they have money" vote at 18%. Bringing up the rear is Newt Gingrich at 17%, coasting along on the "definitely corrupt politician, but maybe he's not crazy" vote. This leaves 26% that doesn't want to vote for any of them. It's called a caucus, like the Democrats, but that process is too complicated for Republicans. They just vote like any other primary. The less-than-bright mayor of Oakland has let slip that there is indeed a conspiracy to evict the Occupy movement from public spaces. The refrain from the supposed representatives of the people is that the First Amendment allows free speech, but no camping. That so-called right to assembly phrase that follows in the same sentence is strangely absent from their talking points. Indeed, in the days of the Constitution's founders, when traveling to New York could take weeks on horseback, the decree that the people wouldn't be allowed to camp on public land in order to petition the government would have been considered as illegitimate. That would have been the position of the Crown and the British East India Company that they rebelled against. It's time to rebel while you still can do it peacefully. Prairie2.com. Tim is in Boston listening on Sirius. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I can't complain.
Oh, good.
Reason I'm calling tonight is I think last week's voting was very telling that the nation as a whole is moving towards more progressive mindset. I think it's I'm very optimistic about next series of elections with not only Elizabeth Warren but also Alan Grayson, maybe some people that can actually get into Washington and make some things happen for the middle class of America. And I think that conservatives are more voting with their heads than their hearts.
I would like to second that motion, except for a couple of caveats. The vote in Ohio to repeal the legislation passed by the Ohio the General Assembly, trying to strip public workers have the right to bargain collectively. The repeal of that, I think, yeah, that's a good sign. It's a shame it had to come in the form of a reaction to a governor that was elected by the people of Ohio. You got to take that into consideration. In Mississippi, I read a very interesting piece in the science section of the New York Times today that while Mississippi is still strongly in favor of butting into a woman's privacy. Hold on just a second, Tim. I'll be right back. We're talking with Tim in Boston. I was going to say that the vote in Mississippi was predicated, believe it or not, on science, because I think a lot of women understood, a lot of people who are anti-abortion, and I say women because they have it is their issue, even though it's been taken away, this idea of control over their own bodies. So the attempts have been made to take it away anyway, and they're ongoing. But I think, again, quoting from Science Times today, there was a pretty big article about why that referendum was defeated. And there were so many women who are anti-abortion, in the state of Mississippi, but who understood the science involved, that in vitro fertilization would be at risk, that a doctor who terminated a fallopian tube pregnancy, that it can be, or in most instances is, if it's not terminated, fatal to the woman, and on and on and on, that that it didn't make
and
any sense.
Stem cell research.
I'm sorry?
And it would stop stem cell research in Mississippi as well.
Right. So I would like to think that there was there has been, and I know some editorialists and some people, the sense is that maybe perhaps the neo-fascists in this country have gone too far and the pushback has begun. I'd like to think that. But I, you know, the old saying, one robin does not a spring make. So let's hope that I want to hope that you're right. I want to hope that there has been a turning here. I just don't know yet, Tim. That's the problem.
Well, we need all the voters out there to continue to stay in contact with their representatives and urge them to vote the way of the people and not the special interest groups, and urge them to oppose or to enforce the Sherman Act, as well as reinstating Glass-Steagall and things of that nature.
Well, I agree that is how it should be done in a society that claims to have representative government. But I think you and I both know, and thanks, Tim, I think you and I both know that's not the way it works. And I think this is what the Occupy movement is about. It is declaring that the system is so corrupted. It's not that the system is broken. It's not broken. It's running just perfectly. But it's running for the wrong people. It's running for the people who are neo-fascists. It's running for the people who now own it. It's their machine. It's their system. So I'm beginning to think that if I think, I'm only talking about myself, if I think that I can affect change by voting for a certain candidate, say, in the Democratic Party, then I am continuing to delude myself. Because my candidate, you know, my member of Congress right now, who replaced Cynthia McKinney and has been reelected, I think, twice, my member of Congress is no more responsive to me or people in this district than the man in the moon. And one of the reasons is because he is going to do exactly what the people who fund him tell him to do. And I don't fund him, and the people in this district don't fund him. The only way to take the corruption out of the system is to take the money out of it. And as long as the money is in it, I don't think voting for any particular candidate, I don't care what that candidate says on the stump, it doesn't matter anymore. You want a good example, immediate example? Barack Obama. Come on, get real here. The system has become so corrupt and all-encompassing in its corruption that it has to be stopped dead in its tracks. It has to be. And voting for a certain candidate who talks a good story during the campaign, I don't think is the way to go. I just don't. I really don't. I think first and foremost, the machine has to be stopped. The system has to be brought to a standstill. That's the only way you get the attention of these bastards. The Occupy movement was the vanguard of getting the attention of the bastards. And the Occupy movement got the attention. And the bastards responded by telling the mayors and the police and the governors and the members of Congress and the media, time to unload on these people. Protest is protest, but this is going too far. So I just cannot. I'm sorry. I'm too far gone to get my mind around the idea that voting for somebody is going to bring the kind of change that is absolutely necessary. Until that voting is not corrupted by the money that's in the system now.
Revolution starts right now. Here's Mike Malloy.
Twenty-five before the hour, I just got a quick note that Robert Reich will be speaking at the UC Berkeley Occupy General Assembly at 8 o'clock Pacific Time, which is about 25 minutes from now. So if you're in that area, you might want to attend that. Robert Reich will be speaking, Clinton's labor secretary and an outspoken blogger and economist. Mark is in with Occupy Seattle. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Mike. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Okay. Sorry, I got pepper sprayed tonight by the Seattle police, and I'm kind of in a lot of pain, but I'll give you a quick report.
I'm sorry to hear that. Do you want to wait to talk? Or?
No, I'm good. My cell phone battery may be going soon.
Okay.
What happened was that people marched in Seattle tonight in solidarity with the folks in New York City that were kicked out of Zuccotti Park.
Right.
And so there was a march that was organized that went from Seattle Central Community College, which is where our encampment is, and went down to Westlake Park, where our original encampment was. Along the way, some people got pepper sprayed as they were marching, and then at 5th and Pine, right in the middle of downtown, the police gave a dispersal order, and as the crowd was deciding whether they wanted to leave or not, they opened up with pepper spray. And I think the main issue that I want to get out here, Mike, is that they pepper sprayed a pregnant woman tonight. That's been verified. So she was taken to the hospital. And all I have to say about that is the police around the country, they really, really need to back off and stop attacking peaceful protesters. Because as far as I know, dancing in the street is not an act of terrorism.
Right.
It's not a violent criminal act. And really, the police should have different ways of responding than showering us with pepper spray. Now, I'm a journalist on top of that, too, and I just wrote an article in the Huffington Post about this. The people really need to call their city, call their mayors, call the city council, call the police departments, and tell them to back off. Here in Seattle, we actually had a resolution passed on Monday that was unanimously endorsed by all of our city council, who all stood up and spoke in favor of the Occupy Wall Street movement and Occupy Seattle. And so we know that we have the support of millions of people around the country, and I'm just really confused about why Mayor Bloomberg and Mayor McGinn here in Seattle and the mayors in Oakland and other cities are allowing the police to use pepper spray and rubber bullets on peaceful demonstrators. I mean, these people are not doing anything violent. They're just expressing their freedom of speech and assembly, and yet they can continually get attacked. And when the police pepper spray a pregnant woman who has to be taken to the hospital, that is not going to help their cause. That is not going to help them look like peace officers.
That's right. What about Councilman Nick Licata? Is he aware of this?
He was not at the march. However, he was the person who introduced the resolution,
right,
which, by the way, is very, very detailed, and it goes into the entire fiscal management of the city and where our money is being held. And one of our demands that they're reviewing is taking our money out of the big corporate banks that got bailouts and putting them in local community banks
Right.
Or maybe even starting a publicly owned state bank like in North Dakota. There's some initiatives that folks in Occupy Seattle are working on with that. And also I want to let everyone know that no matter whether people have occupation sites or not, this movement is not going to end. And if people have to occupy the city hall or the state capitol building, they should do it. And that's what we're going to do on November 28th here. A bunch of people from Occupy Seattle are going to join with groups from all over the state. And we are going to have a Wisconsin-style sit-in at the state capitol building in Olympia here. But I want to let everybody know that regardless of what's happening in Seattle, people are still pumped up. They're still acting nonviolently, peacefully assembling to express their right to freedom of speech. And regardless of how many times we get pepper sprayed, people like me are not going to go home.
Yeah, and I think people like you are starting to number now in the thousands, if not the tens of thousands. This move, Mark, toward violence on the part of the authorities is just absolutely the wrong thing to do. And I agree with you. There should be people calling. I know it's happened here in Atlanta where people will call the mayor's office or did call the mayor's office and say, you know, you got to back off a little bit. These people aren't doing anything illegal except maybe violating a city ordinance about pitching a tent on public property. But the videos I've seen, especially from Occupy Wall Street, from Washington, D.C., and now the situation down in Berkeley is just getting out of hand. And what you've told me about Seattle, that just doesn't seem in keeping with the political atmosphere in Seattle.
Well, no, I wonder sometimes, Mike, and I don't mean to be a conspiracy theorist, but when the same stories keep being told around the country with the same scenario and mayors making the same decision, it starts to make you wonder where those orders are actually coming from.
Well, I heard that the mayor of Oakland let slip yesterday or today in one of the pronouncements from the mayor's office that, yes, there is a movement, a nationwide reaction that is being coordinated, and I don't think who, how, where, or the nuts and bolts obviously are going to come out, at least not now, but the attitude in so many of these cities now, all at the same time, it demands an explanation that it's being coordinated, don't you think? I do. I mean, I really do, and no, I don't think that's conspiratorial.
No, it's very suspicious, and, you know, we just saw our friends down in Portland go through the same thing. And, you know, I think if people out there that are not at the encampments really want to support us, that's one thing that they can do is just start contacting their city government and tell them to back off and tell them that you support the Occupy Wall Street movement, because a lot of folks out there, a lot of working class and middle class people have a lot more political clout than the people that are down on the street taking the pepper spray. So with a little bit of backing from them, maybe we can get the city councils to step up. I know that in Eugene, Oregon, the city council voted to exempt all of the protesters from the city park rules. And we know that in Los Angeles, the city council there passed a resolution endorsing the Occupy Wall Street movement. So if we can continue to get more and more support from the people in our own communities, maybe the police and the mayors will actually get a clue and realize that they actually may be shooting themselves in the foot, figuratively, by alienating people who would normally vote for them, especially in a city like Seattle, where the city council is obviously very progressive and forward-thinking about their approach to us.
Well, that's well put. Mark, let's break off the call. Take care of yourself. Please stay in touch, all right?
I will, Mike. I'll call you back, and thank you for your support.
Oops. I think your phone just went dead. He said his battery was about dead. Kevin is in Colorado Springs. Hi, Kevin.
Good evening, Mike.
Hey.
I got to listen to Keith Oberman tonight before your show.
Uh-huh.
And he had Michael Moore on. In answer to the last gentleman's question where this is coming from, Michael Moore detailed that the Obama Justice Department and the Obama Homeland Security Department have been working with the mayors of these cities to quell back the demonstrators, I guess is the way to put it.
Well, that makes perfect sense. It really does.
Yes, it does. Oh, the other thing is that, and I'll use the word Michael Moore used, President Obama is conveniently on his way to Australia. I don't know if you can get a copy of the statement. I can't eloquate it, as well as Michael Moore did. But essentially, Obama gave a little message supporting the rights of the demonstrators, but at the same time saying each city had to deal with the issue separately. And it's just more of the same, of the wishy-washy, oh, I think things are getting a little bit hairy, so we'll go to Australia, keep our hands out of the mess, and not stand up for the ideals of the people who voted for me.
Well, you know, Obama is what he is, and his administration is what it is. And I think anyone who continues, I know you don't, and I don't, and most people who still have a brain don't. Anyone who continues to think of this administration as progressive or in the interests of the 99% are crazier than a loon. I realize that Obama has gotten a few things passed that seem to benefit the majority of people, but when you take a look at the Affordable Health Care Act and you realize that, okay, there's a mandate in there that all of a sudden produces 40 million new customers for the insurance industry. And yet these dumbasses in the Republican Party continue to call him a socialist. He's no more of a socialist than Bachman is. Bachman is a fascist. And I think anyone who depends on this administration, the Obama administration, to fulfill even close to what he said during the campaign at this point is a fool. Now, we're getting down to that same old argument we've heard so many times. Well, we've got to reelect Obama because what happens if we have a Republican president? What about the Supreme Court? Blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, I've said it before, and I'm sorry I have to say it again. You know, I'm not going to fall for that trap again. I've done that so many times that I'm not going to do it again. Kevin, I got to leave it there. Stay in touch, pal. I hear what you're saying. Thanks for checking in. We'll be right back. Before the hour, this hour has been sponsored by Alice in Arkansas. The whole night has been sponsored by Alice in Arkansas, as will next hour. The message with Alice's second hour sponsorship is this. It's a quote from Abigail Adams. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. Now, the reason Alice is sponsoring the whole night, and with these feminist, or not even feminists, these are suffragist statements, women who are demanding the vote, is because on this day in 1917, something occurred that has been referred to as the Night of Terror, where women who were being held in a jail in Northern Virginia for protesting in front of the White House for months, women finally were arrested and beaten. And during the Night of Terror, they were choked, beaten, hanged up on the cell bars, by the wrists, pinched, twisted, kicked. And when word got out, the protest was so great that the government released them. And 3 years later, women had the right to vote. keep all this in mind, if you don't mind. I'm not trying to be lecturey here. I don't lecture. But keep this stuff in mind as we watch and participate in this organic movement called Occupy. You know, for heaven's sake, I'm not talking to you, Truth Seeker, because I know that you already do this. But I think if all of us just took a quick refresher course on the history of the last century where it concerns all the various human rights movements, whether it was workers' rights or women's rights or gay rights or civil rights or human rights or whatever the rights were, the right for a woman to enjoy privacy, which is what Roe v. Wade was about. It wasn't about a choice of anything. It was about the right to privacy. But for heaven's sake, if we can't take, I mean, all you have to do is just, you don't have to leave your computer terminal. Just go to Wikipedia. Just look up some of the events of the 20th century. We are 11 years into the 21st century. And there is a movement out there that is not going to be stopped. I've been talking, just me, I mean other people certainly much more qualified than I have been talking about this. I personally have been talking about this for half a decade. What's it going to take? When are people going to say enough? At what point will the American people say no more of this garbage? Well, it has started. And I also used to lament about where are the young people? Where it always takes young people to start a movement and sometimes to finish it, to bring it to fruition. Well, they're out there now and they're being pepper sprayed and they're being beaten and they're being gassed and they're being jailed. How much more of this then are we going to put up with? These are our kids. These are our fellow citizens. This is us. And if there is any, even the slightest truth to what Michael Moore suggested, that Homeland Security has passed on the word to the various big city mayors and not so big city mayors, time to crack down, time to let these people know that they've had their 15 minutes. Let's clear the parks. That's it, boys and girls. Time to go home. You made your point. Back to business as usual. If there is the slightest bit of truth to that, then this president, no matter what happens in the next election, this president needs to be a one-term president. And if the next one is a true fascist, then we take to the streets and it won't be peacefully. It's that simple. It's that simple. Mr. Obama has had his chance. He's got one more year. And so far he has been, as far as progressive or liberal ideas or putting this country on the right track spiritually, in terms of democracy, in terms of getting the government out of the clutches of these rancid sons of bitches in the 1%, this president has been an abject failure. A complete failure. And he's not a stupid man. He's not a Herman Cain or a Michelle Bachmann or a Rick Perry or a Rick Santorum. He is an intelligent man. So he knows. He knows he has a year. Don't fall for this crap about, oh, well, you know, what about the Supreme Court, Mike? What do you mean, what about the Supreme Court? The Supreme Court has been lost for over a decade. Don't fall for it again. Don't. Unless this president turns into the leader that we thought he was, then kick his ass out of office. And if somebody on the fascist right takes over, so be it. What is, is. And if it gets too bad to deal with, then Occupy becomes a fond memory. And Tahrir Square becomes the reality. It's that simple. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 7 past the hour. It's the Malloy program. I've tried to stay away from this story for a number of reasons, and I will continue to do so, but I just wanted to add a couple things to the crazed national dialogue that's going on right now about Jerry Sandusky. Whether it is Sandusky, and I believe 10 more victims now have come forward, or Herman Cain, God knows how many more of his victims are going to come forward. They're all using the Clarence Thomas defense, which is just deny everything. Nothing happened. Just nothing happened. Nothing happened. Sandusky's infamous interview last night on NBC about, oh, yeah, well, you know, I shower naked with the boys, maybe, a little horsing around. The reason I'm bringing this up, a radio host in Pittsburgh, Mark Madden, has released some information here that the word shocking doesn't apply. Apparently, Madden, who's been following this case long before Sandusky's sex crimes against young boys became widely known, in April, Madden authored an article for the Beaver County Times, no jokes, please, positing that Sandusky's sex crimes had been swept under the rug by Penn State in the late 1990s in exchange for his quiet resignation. And then he said this, the other thing, this is quote, Mark Madden, quote, here it is here. Madden says that it's becoming apparent, or there is some information. He said, I can give you a rumor, and I can give you something I think might happen. This is what Madden said on the radio. I hear there's a rumor that there will be more shocking developments from the Second Mile Foundation, the one Sandusky formed, of course, in order to get his hands on young boys. Martin goes on, and hold on to your stomach, boys. This is gross. I will use the only language I can, that Jerry Sandusky and Second Mile were pimping out young boys to rich donors. This is being investigated, Mad went on, by two prominent columnists, even as I speak, end quote. Pimping out boys to rich donors. See, when you're in the 1% in this country, you can have anything you want, even sex with children. Procured for you by a famous Penn State sports figure. Of course, it's all alleged. Alleged, alleged, alleged. And when the truth comes out about Herman Cain, and when the truth comes out about this one, the truth comes out about that one, don't you feel sometimes, like I do, that you just, you know, where in the hell are we living? What kind of a bad dream are we living in? Shiva? Are we living in one of Shiva's dreams? Or is it Kalki? Or who's dreaming this reality for us? Which Hindu deity? Let's go with them. What the hell? Why not? You know, which Hindu deity is asleep and dreaming these awful things? Oh, enough. Okay, deep breath. And oh, by the way, the only reason I bring up the Herman Cain garbage is because, first of all, he's such a half-ass. He's just such an idiotic man, which makes him no different from 6 of the 8 other, other candidates who want to be the Republican nominee for president. They're all just such half-asses. I mean, they really are. They really are. But Herman Cain is, I swear to God, just the worst. He's even worse than Sic Santorum You know, Santorum has this thing about dead fetuses and sticking his face into private conversations between a woman and her doctor. But and the rest of them have their whole just a laundry list of weirdness, just weirdness beyond belief, this group. But Herman Cain, his absolute just pushback to anyone who has the temerity to say, you know what, you're so up your eyeballs in sexual assault, verbal assault. That's the only reason I bring up Cain. This half-ass thinks he's going to be president of the United States. And so do a lot of stupid, just deeply stupid Caucasians. 99.9% of Herman Cain's support are all these mouth-breathing, teabag Caucasians. I hate these. I hate these topics. I hate that they're out there. They just turn my stomach. Go away. Go away. Go away. Go away. Get out of here. Get out of my studio. Get away. At a special session of the Nebraska legislature, a state senator there, a Republican, I believe, announced yesterday that TransCanada, the pipeline people, had agreed to adjust its intended route of the Keystone XL oil pipeline to avoid the environmentally sensitive Sand Hills region of the state of Nebraska. Well, hip, hip, hooray, except for one question. Why? Why is TransCanada saying, okay, we'll reroute it? It's perfectly safe, remember? There is no environmental impact anticipated or expected, remember? There's no reason for a bunch of hair-on-fire environmentalists to be running around the state of Nebraska or any place else in the Midwest going, ooh, no pipeline, no pipeline, remember? Well, there's more to the story than just this. A spokesman for the senator who made this announcement in Nebraska said, quote, there had been discussions about this over the last couple of days. Moving it out of that Sand Hills region is important, end quote. Where are you going to move it to, boys? NIMBY, not in my backyard. Where is this monstrosity going to go next? Huh? But notice how quickly TransCanada agreed to this. You got to wonder why. I'll get to it. Now, TransCanada has agreed to do this, and this agreement came, 4 days after a November 10th announcement by the U.S. State Department that it would delay a final decision on this project until the State Department, had considered other routes through Nebraska. Oh, well, TransCanada say, wait, we'll do it here, we'll do it. We'll do it. No problem. We'll reroute it. No problem. And why did the U.S. State Department say it would delay? Because the Obama administration has been under increasing pressure from environmental groups. How many people, 1,700 people arrested in front of the White House protesting this goddamn horror, this destructive continuation of ending life on Earth? And President Obama, why don't you just step out right now and say no to the goddamn thing? Why don't you, Mr. President? Isn't that one of your campaign promises? To lead us away from fossil... Oh, Jesus, never mind. It's just, you know, why do I act like Obama is doing something different from what he was programmed to do to begin with? His campaign rhetoric notwithstanding. You know, I don't know why. I don't know why. More in a second.
Because they think we're fools.
right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. And as the other 2 hours were, this hour also sponsored by Alice Swanson. Alice at Helen Hollers, and her message for this hour is a quote from Emmeline Pankhurst. Quote, "As long as women consent to be unjustly governed, they will be. But directly, women say, we withhold our consent. We will not be governed any longer as long as government is unjust." End quote. Change the word women to people, and you have the Occupy movement. Thanks again, Alice. So the legislators in Nebraska decide that the Keystone XL oil pipeline shouldn't go over the Sand Hills section of a region of the state. And, of course, it begs the question, why not? Of course, TransCanada is so quick to react. Okay, we'll change it. Alex Pourbaix, is that it? Pourbaix, who is TransCanada's president, said, quote, "I can confirm the route will be changed and Nebraskans will play an important role in determining the final route." So, in other words, it still has to go through the state of Nebraska, apparently. But Nebraskans will play an important role, according to Alex Pourbaix. How do you pronounce it, Kathy? P-O-U-R-B-A-I-X. It's French. Bay? Pourbaix?
I think.
You think? Okay. Alex Pourbaix said that in a statement Monday. And he said that TransCanada would support legislation in Nebraska that would shift the pipeline route. Well, okay. Still, it is the State Department that will ultimately decide the fate of this project. And TransCanada's offer of a flexibility, according to the New York Times, does not change the State Department's plans to conduct a fresh environmental review of a new route, a process that will probably take 12 to 18 months and push the final decision into 2013. The State Department must factor in broader environmental concerns about this 1,700-mile pipeline from the bowels of hell to the port of Houston. I think it's Houston. And a spokesman for the State Department said, quote, according to the Times, this is a quote, this is the scary part. This is a spokesman for the New York Times, quote, I'm sorry, spokesman for the U.S. State Department, quote, "We look forward to working with TransCanada and the Nebraska legislature," end quote. And it raises the question again, why? Working with them when your own scientific advisors have tried to tell you that even extracting this guts of hell out of the earth, even the extraction process, is going to bring about a game over attitude on the part of the atmosphere of the earth. Game over. Too much CO2. That's it. Tipping point. Way back there. Here we are. Game over. Learn how to breathe with 3% of your lungs because that's all that's going to be left. Well, again, why doesn't Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama step out of the shadows of the fossil fuel industry? And they're running institutional ads like crazy. The American Petroleum Institute on television, you've seen them. They have black people, white people. They're all standing there saying, oh, yes, this is wonderful. This will generate jobs. And you know what? The oil taken out of the tar sands region will be as clean as other oils. Now, that's, you can take that statement a number of ways, right? But first of all and foremost, it's a lie. It's a filthy lie. It obscures the truth. It destroys the truth. It shoots the truth to death before it's even started to make its journey. But this is how the American Petroleum Institute operates. You know, I keep seeing, I'm having nightmares now. That white woman in the black pants suit who stands there with this spectral look on her face and this grin that reminds me of a death's head telling me, oh yeah, thousands of jobs, hundreds of thousands of jobs. And now they have some black man who's an engineer that works for some oil company and he's standing there also looking like a death's head. I wonder if these people, men, women, black, white, I wonder if they understand when they make these ads, they are contributing to the death of the planet. But they'll do anything for money. A lot of people will do anything for money. They'll say anything on the radio if the money is right, or television if the money's right. Have you ever noticed that? Yeah, I thought you had. We look forward to working with TransCanada, a department spokesman said yesterday. Of course. Sponsored by Alice at Heal and Hollers. And again, the quote from Emmeline Pankhurst. As long as women consent to be unjustly governed, they will be. But directly, women say, we withhold our consent. We will not be governed any longer as long as government is unjust. Emmeline Pankhurst. And as Alice points out, change the word women to people, and you have the Occupy movement. Thanks, Alice. The entire night sponsored by Alice in recognition, as we mentioned first hour, of the arrest and brutal beating of 33 women who had been arrested for peacefully picketing the White House for the right to vote. The way things stay the same, huh? As you know now, the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to hear the challenge to the 2010 health care overhaul law that Obama made his signature legislative achievement. There are going to be oral arguments about this issue in March, decision late June. And the decision will come right in the very heart and soul of the presidential race next year. It'll be very interesting, don't you think? Now, both sides in this are saying, oh, yeah, we're going to win. We know it's constitutional. Oh, yeah, we're going to win. We know it's unconstitutional as hell. The range of issues, according to the Times, that the court agreed to address amounted to a menu of possible resolutions. The Supreme Court could uphold the law. The Supreme Court could strike down just its most controversial provision, or some or all of the rest of it, or duck a definitive decision entirely as premature. Not time to make a decision. Tensions are running very high through this case. You know how a lot of teabag freak bastards in this country have made what they call Obamacare the centerpiece of their psychosis, and they've done a good job of it. I'm not familiar with seeing people running around with their hair on fire talking about how the republic is falling because some sort of health care law was passed. I mean, Jesus Christ, these people are they're like dirt on the bottom of your shoe. These right-wingers, the teabaggers, the Republicans, the conservatives, whatever collective noun you want to use for these freaks. But anyway, there are 26 states challenging the law. So those are two sides. 26 states on one side, the federal government on the other. And in the middle, the Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice John Roberts, who is an avowed enemy of Obama, to the point where Roberts couldn't even do the damn oath of office without stumbling over his own tongue as he stood there and tried to address a black man who was now becoming president of the United States. John Roberts just couldn't handle it. You remember that precious moment, don't you? Now, the court is scheduled 5.5 hours for arguments instead of the usual one. So, this is a big deal. As the Times says, it's hardly clear, for instance, that a Supreme Court ruling upholding the law would help only Mr. Obama. As opponents of the law, then might redouble their efforts to elect candidates committed to repealing it, you see? On the other hand, a decision striking down the law might allow Mr. Obama to court voters unhappy with that decision, as he did in cases like Citizens United. So here we go. The politicization, well, you try to say it fast, of an issue that has no business being in the realm, as far as I'm concerned, the realm of politics at all. I mean, come on, this is healthcare! Jesus God! Now, the Supreme Court agreed to hear appeals from just one decision. That's a decision that came out of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit right here in Atlanta. And that was the only one so far that struck down the mandate, the insistence that people buy health insurance or they're in deep doo-doo. Now, stop and think about it. I think every state in the union has the same insistence for car insurance. But never mind. The Republic didn't fall when they made it mandatory for car insurance. But, ooh, health insurance. You see how insane this is? Now, that decision striking down the mandate, that was, by the way, it's a 3-judge panel. I think the ruling was 2-1. So even that was not unanimous. It said the mandate overstepped congressional authority and could not be justified by the constitutional power that the feds have, quote, to regulate commerce, or, quote, to lay and collect taxes, end quote. That somehow requiring the purchase of insurance overstepped the boundary. Now, that segment of the law contained two other provisions that the Obama administration says are absolutely intertwined. So in other words, if they strike down the mandate section, then the other two will come down too. One of those provisions forbids insurers from turning away applicants. And the other forbids insurers from taking account of pre-existing conditions. Okay? So the mandate part really is the very heart of this legislation. There are other aspects in the legislation, like young people can stay on their parents' insurance until age 25, and so on and so forth. But this is the heart and soul of it. The 11th Circuit here in Atlanta did rule against Florida and the other states that brought this case on one of their other central arguments. The 11th Circuit here rejected a challenge to the law's expansion of the Medicaid program, which also is part of this. So what is interesting to me is who's going to hear this. There have been calls for Clarence Thomas to step aside. And usually when it's announced a case will be heard, that's when the announcement is made whether or not one or two of the Supremes will step aside, because they will be biased as to the outcome. Clarence Thomas has not said he'll step aside. And he should, based on the activities of his wife, Jeannie, in groups opposed to the law. Now, some conservatives, the way they always do, the right wing, well, Elena Kagan should step aside, too. Why? Well, she's had involvement in health care lawsuits when she was United States Solicitor General. No, she didn't. She might have had some input, some advice and consent input into the writing of the law. But she had nothing to do with lawsuits. Oh, that doesn't matter. We're teabaggers. We don't give a goddamn. We'll say anything. Well, what about Ginny? 74 members of Congress have signed a letter asking Clarence Thomas to step aside, to recuse himself from any ruling on the Affordable Care Act because of Gianni's work as a conservative activist and lobbyist, where she specifically agitated for the repeal of what the right wing calls Obamacare. Now, of course, the recusal effort was spearheaded by Anthony Weiner. You remember him? Boom, crash. Doesn't matter. As The Nation reported recently, in 2009, Ginny Thomas founded some piece of right-wing crap called the Liberty Central, a conservative nonprofit that she said would fight President Obama's hard left agenda. Hard left? What do these asses use for brains? What the hell does this Ginny Thomas use for gray matter? Hard left Obama? Oh, but never mind. Anyway, she said she, quote, felt called to the front lines with you, my fellow citizens, to preserve what made America great, end quote. Apparently what made America great was no health care. See, these people, they're like rabid dogs. They're insane. They're just insane. Their brains are just a swirling mass of right-wing rhetoric that just stays there all the time. Her group put lie after lie into the mainstream conversation. One of them was that it would be a disaster for small businesses. Now, Ginny's involvement has created a lot of concern among legal experts, worried about the obvious conflict of interest, given that her husband would likely rule on challenges to the law. Moreover, Liberty Central, Ginny's little organization, was taking unlimited and secret donations, something that was aided by Clarence Thomas's ruling in Citizens United. You see how this works? Clarence Thomas should be have his massive ass thrown off the court and take your old lady with you. I mean, this is ridiculous. But this is fascist America, you see. The liberal group Common Cause complained to the Justice Department at the time that Liberty Central was taking unlimited and secret donations thanks to her husband's ruling, Ginny's husband's ruling. And Common Cause noted, quote, the complete lack of transparency of Liberty Central's finances makes it difficult to assess the full scope of the ethics issues raised by Mrs. Thomas's role in founding and leading the group, end quote. Ginny Thomas resigned then from Liberty Central late last year amid controversy. But a few months later, she returned as head of Liberty Consulting, a new firm designed to focus Ginny's experience and connections, you like that word, to help clients with governmental affairs efforts. Yeehaw! Before the hour. So, Uncle Clarence Thomas and his old lady Ginny. Clarence is about to voice his opinion on a key issue facing the United States, one that is going to have the decision around this issue is going to have effects, political effects, as well as healthcare effects for years to come. And Uncle Clarence's old lady Ginny founded Liberty Central, a conservative nonprofit that she said would fight Obama's hard left agenda and return America to Americans and stop Obamacare in its tracks. In the words of Common Cause lawyer Ann Pearson earlier this year, quote, Ginny Thomas's activities raise questions about whether Justice Thomas can be unbiased and appear to be unbiased in cases dealing with the repeal of the health care reform law or corporate political spending when his wife is working to elect members of the Tea Party and also advocating for their policies, end quote. It's people like Uncle Clarence and the rest of these people who, I'm sure, inspired Alice at Helen Hollers to sponsor this evening's program, the entire 3 hours. Her message for this last hour: as long as women consent to be unjustly governed, they will be. But directly, women say, we withhold our consent. We will not be governed any longer as long as government is unjust. End quote, Emmeline Pankhurst, from less than 100 years ago. So, as Alice points out, change the word women to people, and you have the Occupy movement. It really is kind of simple to understand what the Occupy movement's about, isn't it? Oh, but where's your leaders? Look in the mirror. And as the Nation says about whether or not Clarence Thomas will recuse himself from the Affordable Health Care Act hearing coming up, it's likely to be the most important case for these Supreme Court justices since they destroyed democracy with their Bush v. Gore ruling. Remember that? That was the day the music stopped. That was the day democracy died in this country. And you should remember it well, December 12th, 2000. That was when the bell tolled for democracy. And as the poet said, send not for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee. So here we are. Essentially the same five negative neo-fascist forces on the Supreme Court about to rule on the Affordable Care Act. And it will certainly be, as the Nation points out, the clearest test yet of Clarence Thomas's ascendancy at the court. As the Nation says, Thomas's entire career as a judge has been building toward the moment when he would be able to declare that law unconstitutional. It would be not only a victory for his approach to the Constitution, but also, it seems, a defeat for the enemies who have pursued him for so long. Liberals, law professors, journalists. The group that Uncle Clarence refers to collectively as the elites. As the Nation points out, Thomas's triumph over the health care law and its supporters is by no means assured, but it is now tantalizingly, for Uncle Clarence, within reach. So, once again, an issue that goes to the core of what this country is about is pretty much going to be determined, isn't it? By five neo-fascists on the Supreme Court. Now, how do you think they're going to rule on the Affordable Care Act? Do you think they are going to rule in favor of the constitutionality of this law, which I think most legal scholars agree it is constitutional? I know that was a completely insane sentence, but you get what I'm trying to say. Or is the Supreme Court going to once again legislate from the bench? You know, the right-wingers are always talking about that, right? Activist court! Activist court! Except when they're presented with a case, Citizens United, that had nothing to do, nothing whatsoever to do, with unlimited corporate funds further polluting the political system, but they ruled that way anyway, even though that was not the question in front of them. And these right-wing bastards have the audacity to refer to any progressive or liberal or Democrat or centrist or moderate on the court as activist, when historically it's been the right wing constantly that has tried to undermine the rule of law. Constantly, without let-up. And it appears that we're going to go down that road again. We'll see. So the hearings come in March, and a decision will come in June. And then the feathers will start flying. Alice also sent me this, a quote from Utah Phillips. The earth is not dying, it's being killed. And the people killing it have names and addresses. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.